And now, Taking Care of Business, your hosts, Craig Moen and Shai Gilad.
Welcome to Business Owners Radio, episode 224. Today, we're taking a step back in time with an encore production of our interview with Sam Mallikarjanan, CEO and co-founder of OneScreen.ai, a pandemic-produced startup set on overhauling the archaic out-of-home advertising industry. Sam is the former head of growth at HubSpot Labs. He taught advanced digital marketing, innovation management, and strategic economics at Harvard University and is co-author of the best-selling book, How to Sell Better Than Amazon, which is, thanks to the publisher, ironically available for purchase on Amazon. Good morning, Sam. Welcome to Business Owners Radio.
Morning, Craig. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you back. It's been a while and you've been busy and you've been bouncing around in a lot of new startup sectors and you're in the out-of-home advertising segment, but I had to stop there and ask you to define that a little bit for us. Some of us in our audience may not be familiar with that term.
So for what it's worth, a year and a half ago, I didn't know what out-of-home advertising was either. This originally started as just a hackathon with some former HubSpot employees trying to help small businesses. We saw the screens that small businesses like cigar lounges, restaurants, bars, and said, what if we could create a Google Display Network for the real world and these businesses could make money to help them survive the lockdowns from quarantine and COVID and things like that. So we built that prototype. Then we started calling people in the media industry. We jokingly called our reverse stealth mode. We called everybody and told them what we were planning to do. And that's where we learned about the broader concept of out-of-home advertising. It's a terrible name for a category. It's the only one that defines itself by what it is not. But most people think of like billboards or mass transit ads, but also includes ads in malls, ads in airports, wrapped cars. You can wrap an ice cream truck and drive it around town. You can sponsor Little League teams through our marketplace. So it's really this concept of everything that's offline. So nerds like me have spent 20 years optimizing marketing for internet channels, for online channels. But there's never really been the ability to easily deploy, measure, and optimize campaigns in offline channels. So after our hackathon, we decided to build a marketplace to enable all of that for business owners.
Have a good visual on that now. Appreciate it. So in starting your business, how did you evolve and how did the organization take place and how was it structured?
So it was interesting that we launched as a result of COVID, and at the same time, COVID was forcing everybody to shift to remote. At the time, I was chief revenue officer for a company called Flock.com, and we were not remote. It was a global company, but we had offices in Asia as well as the United States. But we sort of were worried that COVID might lead to lockdowns. And so we started stress testing what would be required to suddenly have 700 people working remotely, still have secure connections, everything else like that. So we started that experiment. We were going to run it for 2 weeks. And then 10 days into our two-week experiment, the lockdowns actually happened. So fortunately, we had a 10-day head start on the rest of the companies in the world because we were already trying to figure out how to have that many people work remotely. Unfortunately, as a result of the lockdowns, the impact on business and VC funding, I had to lay off a bunch of people, including myself. And laying off myself is a unique experience in my career, but it was the right thing to do. And so I had a lot of free time. And that's when I got together with the former HubSpot colleagues. Now, HubSpot has not historically been a remote first team. But when I was running HubSpot Labs with who is now my co-founder, Andre, we were one of the first remote teams at HubSpot. And one of the issues we ran into was that you sort of had insiders and outsiders. You had people who were in Boston who felt like, quote unquote, real HubSpotters. And then you had people who were remote who kind of felt isolated. What's weird about now is everybody's an outsider. So we lose all of the social context. We lose all the socialization. Being on Zoom 12 hours a day is not a natural thing for humans. So our organization is built fully remote right now because we have to be. And it creates a lot of advantages. Lets people work from home, lets people live where they want. I'm currently on the beach in Florida instead of having to live in Boston where it's expensive and cold. But it also creates a lot of alignment and communication challenges. But the good thing is, unlike most companies which have to shift to being remote, we've built from the ground up as a remote first team. So we didn't have to eat the pain of change that most companies have had to eat over the last 18 months.
Let's dig into that a little bit, Sam. I mean, so you built this from the ground up. What did you learn in constructing your company that way as effectively a remote working construct?
There are a few key challenges. One is, if COVID has done anything good, it's that it has forced us to acknowledge that the person on the other side of the Zoom call is also a human being. I remember it might have been 2 years ago or something. The guy was doing an interview for like the BBC and his kid run into the room in the background. And then the mom like comes and takes the kid away. And that was so rare and so funny that it went viral and made all the major news channels. Now that's just a fact of life. Like your dogs are going to bark, your kids are going to interrupt you, you're going to take vacations, et cetera. We've all had to acknowledge the fact that the vicissitudes of life, if you will, the issues of life are going to overlap with the issues that people have at work. However, we've also lost the ability to think of each other and interact with each other in non-work contexts. And when you think of somebody only as a coworker or as a colleague, it makes your ability to communicate, your ability to innovate, your ability to trust effectively a lot harder. So if it's all work oriented all the time, you actually are less productive when trying to work with someone else. Not just like you lose context over Slack, right? Because you don't have tone, but you're actually not thinking about the way you're communicating to that person within the context of what's going on in their life, how they communicate, et cetera. The biggest challenge by far has been, how do we create a culture in a context where all of the elements of what's naturally human culture, the early morning coffee, the running into people in the hallway, all that kind of stuff, are things that we can't do. And we've got the morning office hours, we've got the Friday afternoon coffee talk, we've got some of these things. I definitely wouldn't say that we've nailed it. We've also tried playing some like virtual games with each other through a company called Tour Guides. But that's been the biggest challenge for me by far, is not project management or alignment or anything else like that. It is the culture and having people communicate effectively, not lose their patience with each other, convey what they're trying to convey, especially in a startup, when you can't actually see and interact with the other person in a way that's natural to humanity. Add to that an underlayer of everybody's stress is ratcheted up to 7. And yeah, it's been the most challenging 18 months of my career.
When we think about the world beyond COVID, which of course we all hope we'll get there soon, how do you see this evolving in terms of creating spaces to interact more for the purposes of building trust and building cohesiveness as a team beyond some of the online solutions? What does the future of work look like, do you think?
I think the pendulum has swung so far in the other direction that it's been an interesting contrast. Like, extremes are useful sometimes because it's like binging on a food you really, really like and then can't eat it again for years. You know, like the extreme isolation and the extreme lack, total inability to go to work has shown us that there are things we do value about being in person. And so while I don't think everybody's going to always work remotely forever, there are lots of advantages to having in-person collaboration and the resources of an office. I really wish I had an IT team. And there are people who prefer working in an office. They feed off that energy. Mentorship and coaching and things like that, especially for things like sales and such, are sometimes a lot easier in person. There's lots of good reasons to go to the office. But I think that this oversaturation of remote work has shown us that we're not all going to go back to the office. So the future is definitely going to be hybrid for almost everyone. And I'm really interested in, for example, like venture capital funds. There used to be this weird bias where they wanted to, quote unquote, bike to their portfolio. It's like San Francisco companies wouldn't invest in you unless you were a San Francisco tech startup. And as my wife is really, really enjoying not having to live in a place where it snows, I'm wondering right now, like, you know, when we raise our next round of funding, for example, are investors going to even care if we have an office? And if they do care, do they care where it is? Like, is it going to have to be Boston or New York City or San Francisco for us to engage with one of the large venture capital firms? So I think the future is definitely going to be hybrid and sort of modularized. Like, we need to be able to create these clusters of interactions. We need to be able to give people options to interact with other folks in the real world, give them resources. You know, like, we give you budget to make your office space comfortable because we'd be spending that on an office anyways. And if the employee spends it on a potted plant, okay, we probably would have had potted plants or something at the office anyways. Like, I think we're really rethinking how companies need to support the work at home space and how we need to create hybrid models so that not everybody has to be in the same office all the time. Definitely not fully remote. I don't think that's a good thing. I don't think that people want it, but I think it'll be hybrid. And I think, frankly, we're all learning how much time and money we were wasting on travel. Like when I was leading the team in Asia, I think I did 500,000 miles in the air that year, right? I spent a little over 98 days or so in hotel rooms. I just lost my diamond medallion status at Delta, and I lost my diamond status at Hilton. And it is an incredible point of pride for me because it turns out maybe I didn't need to be spending all of that company money and all of that time traveling when sometimes a Zoom call would suffice.
I agree with you, Sam. It's amazing when you're not sitting in an airline seat, how many other things you can be doing. And when you're not away from home in some hotel, how connections are disrupted while you're on travel and how much more efficient one can be. The element that's curious to me is what's working and what isn't. When you're pulling this remote team of high volume together, what were the learnings of what was working and what wasn't working? And what were the new protocols of communication and accepted behaviors and so forth? What were you recognizing?
So I kind of cheated because the majority of our team here at OneScreen.ai are former early stage HubSpotters. So a lot of us knew each other. We'd worked together in the past. And we had a shared sort of cultural DNA from our time at HubSpot. That being said, I don't think we have figured it out perfectly. Even things like how much do you let people make jokes and such? Like, you know, that can kind of come off weird when you're on a Zoom call. There's this weird new dynamic, by the way, where like almost every call gets recorded, which we didn't used to record every meeting, but we record every calls for people who can't be there, which changes the dynamic. Not everybody likes having their camera on. So I'm famous for this at our company. Like, I don't want to have to stare into everybody's eyes the entire time, but I also don't want to have them see me looking up and away because I'm thinking about something else. So really rethinking the ways in which we set limitations around communication, the nonverbal signals that we would normally use to politely interrupt somebody on a meeting or to weigh in don't exist. And Slack can add all the buttons they want with raised hands and stuff like that, but nobody's going to use them. So there's a huge amount of sensitivity and additional management of the meetings, like being more proactive, making sure that managers should do this anyways. But if there's somebody in a meeting who isn't volunteering their opinion, asking for their opinion, giving them permission and specific time and saying like, hey, you know, what do you think about what we're talking about right now? A lot of that sort of cognitive load that managers didn't have to do when we were in person and in a meeting room and we could joke at the beginning of the meeting and everything else like that, or you could just see somebody wanted to say something, we have to be a lot more proactive about it. The other thing is, again, just dealing with the fact that if human beings have a stress capacity of like 0 to 10, we'll call it, right? Normally we're all at like a 3, which leaves us 7 stress points available for work. For a while there, we were all at like a 7 or an 8. So there were only 2 stress points available for work. Now we're maybe all back down to like a 5. But being able to proactively manage people's level of stress, especially as it relates to performance. Performance metrics are difficult under the best of circumstances, but they're really, really important for small businesses and startups that are trying to grow, that we be able to give people goals so they have a definition of success at work and measure output, measure yield, measure performance. But the normal approach that we might take to performance management and setting goals and such isn't necessarily something that we can do the way we've done it for the last 100 years. Even just think about my industry. So like out of home advertising, for example, mass transit ads are a big category for us. How the heck do I set the sales team's quota when the government is going to randomly shut down the mass transit system, right? Or, you know, how do I deal with the customer success team and their communication and their efficiency and their output and their throughput when the social support infrastructure that we're used to them having has gone away? They can't go see their family. They can't go out with friends and blow off steam. that's been a huge lesson and challenge for us, is how we think about building in parameters for performance management, and how managers, this is something I tell all of my managers now, like, we didn't used to have to be therapists, and that may not seem well within the scope of our jobs, but I am far more concerned about employees burning out or miscommunicating and aligning poorly and getting snippy with each other, et cetera, than I am about them not working hard enough. It's kind of like in Boston, I grew up in Florida, so this was a weird thing to me. In Boston, like, everybody gets snippy with each other in winter because you don't see the sun and you're cold and everything else like that. And it was the weirdest phenomenon I'd ever seen, because I live in a happy place. That phenomenon is happening now all the time everywhere. So like at HubSpot, people used to have these little blue lights on their desk, I guess, to simulate the fact that they were seeing the sun, so they would be less snippy with their coworkers. We need the management equivalent of that, which is changing how we think about strategy, how we change forecasting. The good news is all of our competitors are also in the same boat. So this isn't a localized phenomenon, and it's not something that is specific to one industry, which is one of the reasons you see so many startups growing so fast right now, because they're agile, because they're adaptive. And when the weather is terrible and when the environmental conditions are awful, it's the smaller, adaptable people who are going to like grind through and work harder. They have a much, much bigger competitive advantage than they have when the environment is calm and stable. So it's harder in many ways to be a small business or startup now than it was when we talked back in 2017 for the first time. But it's also easier, because the large competitors that might otherwise be keeping us down are being hurt far worse than we are in terms of our adaptability and agility.
It's interesting you mentioned about, we address the physical side of everyone's presence and getting outdoors maybe, but the mental side of the business leadership has been growing tremendously, and a lot of new reports and studies out on it. And I find it with my clients also that this topic comes up quite often as far as helping their remote employees deal with their everyday life, with being relevant to the company, feeling like they're a part of it. What are some of the things that didn't work in your environment that you saw during this process?
Coffee talks and general stuff like that doesn't work, because it's not the extroverts that we have to be worried about. Those people are going to figure out a way to have fun and be energized, et cetera. And we can do something easy like coffee talk. Far more proactive one-on-ones, which even pre-COVID, one-on-ones are not for performance reviews. Okay. We've got automated dashboards for that. One-on-ones are an opportunity for employees to talk to you about their life at work and for you to hear what they mean, not what they say. I actually have one-on-ones with every person in our company, except some of our engineers, because they're based in Ukraine and I don't speak the same language. And the reason I do that is because that has been by far the most effective mechanism, is having dedicated time for the employees to have them know that I'm going to be there and listen, and they can talk and there's no agenda. That is something managers should have been doing anyways. You should be doing one-on-ones with your employees, and you definitely shouldn't set the agenda. They can set the agenda if they want to, but you should spend most of the time listening. There's a joke at our company about me and my cigar breaks, but I maintain cigars are a wonderful tool for managers, because if it goes out, it means you're talking too much and you're not listening enough. But that has worked. What has not worked has been, first of all, not addressing the issue, or just pretending like that's outside of the scope of the manager's role, which is, again, controversial. We have young employees. We have employees who are scared, and we have employees who aren't particularly good at vetting news. And we put out health guides and things like that. When I was still at Flock, we had some junior employees who thought like you could get COVID from eating meat and things like that. And it's not normally considered part of the manager's responsibility or the corporate responsibility to handle a lot of those issues. But it's the reality of the situation that we have right now. So I would say the biggest thing that has not worked well is refusing to address it. Like, just trying to continue with business as normal is a really dumb idea right now. And also finding one size fits all solutions, like generic office hours or coffee breaks or whatever, happy hours, that's not going to work either. for the different types of employees at your company in different functions who have to interact with different people in different ways, you're going to have to design multiple solutions to make it work, to help them adapt to the reality of what's going on.
Well, Sam, it sounds like you've just learned so many things about this process as you've created your team and developed your team at onescreen.ai. For the rest of us, though, we've been sort of forced in a lot of ways to transition to at least some of our workforce operating in more of a remote fashion. And so it's a little bit of a disjointed culture. You know, in some cases, some of us have some people that are in the office and some people that are able to work remotely just because of the nature of their jobs and the responsibilities required. And it almost creates this inadvertent inequity. And that's been a really hard thing to manage. What can business owners do right now? Like, what are some steps they can take right now? And what kinds of tools do you think they can use to start to create a more cohesive culture as they go through this change?
It's easy to manage everybody in one place. And it's actually easy to manage everybody being remote. The hardest is to manage a hybrid. And I had this with HubSpot at HubSpot Labs, as I kind of alluded to earlier. There were people who felt like they were real HubSpotters because they were in Boston. And then there were people who like kind of felt isolated. They were on the outside. They didn't have the social interactions and that stuff. But they also, for example, didn't have the access to senior leadership like the people who were in Boston had. Anyone on the team in Boston could grab me for coffee or something like that if they wanted to talk. Whereas the people who were remote couldn't do that because booking a calendar event with me, it just feels more formal. The mindset that I recommend is solve for the most disadvantaged group in any given setting. That's the same reason you see diversity and inclusion initiatives at companies getting so much investment right now, is like solving for the people where they have the majority of advantages is easy. But even when you think about meetings, right? Don't get up and write on a whiteboard that is out of the range of the camera. Like, you have to be proactively designing everything for the person who is most disadvantaged, which are the people who are going to be remote. Having the people who do come into the office, you don't have to force them to work remote sometimes, but if you give them the option, they'll usually take it because people like working from home, at least on occasion, so that they also experience some of what it's like to be remote, to be outside of the office. Creating as much of a bias towards how do I make communication and collaboration as useful as possible for people who are remote? And then remembering the things that those people lose. You feel like you have insiders and outsiders. You have to solve for that. Like, I'm not as worried about taking people out for drinks or whatever if they are in physical proximity to me, especially with, for example, managing people who aren't as extroverted, who don't advocate for themselves and their own career growth and advancement. Being much, much more intentional about that, calling out the successes of the people who are remote who aren't necessarily going to call it out themselves. You know, we can't ring a giant bell every time somebody closes a deal and we're all in the same room and everybody applauds. That's not a thing anymore when you're remote. So the mind shift has to be developing an extreme sense of empathy as a leader and creating and enforcing a bias towards being remote friendly. Like, if somebody in the meeting gets up and writes on the whiteboard, you need to tell them, please sit back down and articulate what you were trying to say for the people on the call. Again, it comes back to that managers now have a new responsibility, which is that we have to proactively manage the experience of communication between teams. Life is faster and more difficult now. I did not used to have to compete with every single person in every single city, in every single country, 24 hours a day. That has made it so the competitive pressures on companies and leaders and employees themselves are incredibly high, and the stress that that puts on you and being able to proactively manage that. Like, at any given point in time, I could be working on something. And for people who are highly motivated, that is a very uncomfortable feeling. Whereas if we didn't have Zoom and laptops, you know, before cell phones and stuff like that, when I got home, I couldn't be working. So even if I wanted to be, I didn't have to feel bad about it. Now, at all times, when I'm sleeping, I can be working. And that's an additional stressor. When it comes to time zones, what's interesting is that work has always been either asynchronous or synchronous. We either have meetings and conference calls, or we send a memo. Now we have the advent of semi-synchronous communication, where, you know, especially Slack, I schedule Slack notifications to go out. I set reminders. There are things where the workflow does not have to happen synchronously in order for it to be executed effectively. It has increased overall throughput and production. So like, if you just think of a workplace as like a manufacturing plant, right? Like, let's dust off our Lean Six Sigma certifications from way back in the day and just think about like a Donald's manufacturing burgers here. It's a lot more efficient to have a slightly slower pace of things being built that's operating 24 hours a day and operating at full capacity than have something that is operating at full capacity. And even if it's going faster, but it's limited to a shortened period of time. So I actually think it increases overall productivity when companies get good at asynchronous communication and collaboration. Not everything's urgent, right? It's just not. Let's look over at my Slack channel right now. I've got 5 people who have Slacked me since we started this interview, and I've got 12 emails that have been sent to me. I guarantee you, maybe one of them is something that requires my attention within the next 2 hours. And when we had to choose between synchronous and asynchronous communication, we didn't have the luxury of making that decision. But like, you had to be in the meeting. You had to be on the conference call. It's a joke. You can buy a mug on Amazon that says, I survived another meeting that should have been an email, right? Now we have a lot more flexibility and adaptability. I'll add one more interesting thing, which is cultures and exposure to different cultures. So because we're remote, because we're in different time zones, it's not just the East Coast and the West Coast of the United States. Like, we've got people in Europe, we've got people in Asia, and having the team learn about different cultures and different mindsets and different ways of thinking is an incredible strategic advantage. Our plans to expand into APAC a lot sooner than most startups would is in large part informed by the fact that we've got folks in APAC who have been talking to our product and sales teams and talking to them about like some of the ways the challenges are different between cultures and some of the mindsets about adopting new technologies and methodologies and things like that. So it's very interesting. I actually think time zones are net a good thing, but it is, again, one more thing that leaders and managers have to actively manage and think about.
Sam, take us back a little bit on where the marketing challenges have been in the past and how they progressed. And most importantly, where do you see this all going as far as with the speeds of messaging and so forth? What does it look on the horizon to you?
In terms of speed, everything is trending towards faster. We have more competitors. We have to move faster. We have to iterate faster. That is inherently going to favor smaller, more agile companies. It's also going to favor companies that have been hampered by industry dynamics that are just slow to change. So, you know, out of home advertising, as I mentioned, it's been the same way for hundreds of years. It's the oldest marketing medium. Ever since there's been people, there's been somebody writing like this week's mastodons on a specials on a cave wall somewhere. And other than sometimes answering the telephone, there hasn't been a huge amount of innovation since then. When COVID hit, it forced the industry to confront the fact that they needed to evolve. They needed to adapt to new ideas. Same thing for small businesses, especially in the retail segments. We had to rethink the relationships with our customers. We had to rethink the way we deliver products and services. All of that creates a huge amount of strain, but it also creates a lot of opportunity. So people who can be adaptable can take advantage of a lot of the opportunities for change that have been created over the last year. From a marketing perspective, the world has become more humanized over the last year. Like, we care about things. We talk about things. There are conversations about society and about inequity and about the economy and about health and such that are on people's minds and are topics that people discuss. And I joke that there's 3 things we don't talk about: politics, religion, and PC versus Mac, because nobody can have a rational conversation about any one of those 3 topics. But other than that, like, there are topics that brands are now internally and externally expected to weigh in on and have an opinion, to have a position. The big thing for marketing, though, is digital. And when I say digital, I specifically mean the internet we have been oversaturated with digital channels, internet channels for the last 18 months. We're all caught up on our friends. None of us need to spend more time on Facebook. I am so caught up on what my random friends from high school have going on in their lives. It's insane. We're all caught up on our Netflix queues. We've read the articles. The internet marketing channels are where we generally insert advertising or inbound marketing experiences, are things that are actually just draining to consumers nowadays. So you have to think about ways to reach people that are new. You can't just keep running Facebook ads and Google ads because we've become numb to them. We've doom scrolled on Facebook so much that your Facebook ads, even barring anything else, we just have exposure fatigue to internet-based marketing channels. At the same time, those internet-based advertising channels and marketing channels have become ridiculously optimized. I mean, again, nerds like me have spent 20 years trying to squeeze every last 10th of a percentage yield we can out of internet channels. And then at the same time, you've got the trend towards privacy. So your Facebook ads are about to get more expensive and less effective because with worse targeting, you're going to have more people bidding on the same audience. So the prices are going to go up and that audience is going to be less relevant. So the efficacy is going to go down. So I think a lot of us got addicted to relatively easy and straightforward channels of growth. Internet marketing actually used to be easy. I remember in 2006, I got a cigar website to rank for the term health insurance because I was bored once. Now, internet marketing is not only hard, it is a strategic threat to your business if that's the only growth channel that you have to rely on. Again, like I think this decade is going to be defined by pendulums swinging so far in the overcorrection direction that it brings things back to a more sane mid-range. Marketers have to become comfortable with strategies that can't be measured with a click. And we're going to have to start thinking a lot more about brand, a lot more about how we're making people feel and creating experiences. Because first of all, we're tired of running our 5,000th A/B test on Google AdWords. Second of all, that's just not going to work anymore. We're not going to be able to deliver growth for our businesses if we think about marketing in 2022 the way we thought about marketing in 2019.
Well, Sam, I really appreciate the time we had today, and thank you so much for joining us.
My absolute pleasure. I look forward to talking again in 4 years.
Sounds good. Hopefully a lot sooner. Is there anything else you'd like to leave with our audience today?
The two big takeaways is be willing to throw out everything you think you know and you think is correct. This includes like what is your job and what is the scope of your role? You need to get good at things that you probably don't want to get good at, that you never had to get good at before. And frankly, that 10 years ago, it would have been probably considered inappropriate for you to get good at or be thinking about those things. Two is challenge all of your underlying biases in terms of the right answer. I have had to challenge more assumptions of mine in the last 18 months than in my entire career. And I'm somebody who studied innovation and disruption literally professionally. Like it was my job to think about like what if things could change and how things could change. And yet over the last 18 months, so much has changed and it's had so many varied impacts that I have just thrown out my own belief that I actually understand everything that's going on. Like head of marketing did a direct mail campaign a couple of weeks ago. I'm like, you know what? Fine. I don't know. I don't care. Let's see if it works now. Maybe things have changed. So get really, really good at challenging and understanding when you're making assumptions and when you have a reflexive bias towards something that used to be a value add because you could think faster, you could iterate faster if your brain could dismiss things faster and focus in on things you thought were interesting. But if you find yourself dismissing a concept or an opportunity, pay attention to when that's happening and proactively challenge yourself because that is the great threat to businesses in the 2020s, and also the great opportunities to people who want to create growth and innovation. Also, take a vacation. Seriously, I'm taking my first vacation since we started this thing next week. And it's not like a cool vacation. My wife's not one of your listeners, so I'll tell you, I had a trip planned to the Amazon for her and it was gonna be awesome and got canceled because of COVID and everything else like that. Now I'm just taking her to Orlando for the week. You and your employees are probably not taking enough time off because there's nowhere to go and there's nothing to do. Take vacations, make your employees take vacations. You don't grow muscles when you're working out at the gym. You grow muscles when you rest. So that's my closing thoughts to leave with y'all is think about how you think in a different way moving forward.
Our guest today has been Sam Mallikarjanan, CEO and co-founder of OneScreen.ai, a pandemic-produced startup set on overhauling the archaic out-of-home advertising industry. You can learn more about Sam as well as find links to his content, all on our website at businessownersradio.com.
Thank you for joining us on Business Owners Radio. We hope you enjoyed today's show. As always, you can read more about each episode along with links and offers in the show notes on our website, businessownersradio.com. We want to hear your feedback. Please leave comments on this show or suggestions for upcoming episodes. Tell your fellow business owners about the show, and of course, we would love the stars and comments on iTunes. Till next time, keep taking care of business.